Well-being is actually a leadership skill set. It's a skill set that can be trained, however we don't train it. It needs to move out of the realm of being a nice-to-have or soft skill and become an essential skill that, to date, most organizations have kind of left it to chance and said, well, we have some managers that are good at it and some that aren't. And that's just not cutting it. It needs to be something that people are taught that is part of the performance expectations. You need to know how to lead through the lens of well-being if you are a people leader or manager at an organization.
Greetings and a warm welcome back to Intersections. Our aspiration here is to dissolve boundaries. And today, one of those critical interfaces, boundaries that we want to kind of invite us to dissolve is between work and life, between who you are officially and professionally and who you are as a human being and personally. And to have that conversation with us, I can't think of a really more of a perfect fit than Jen Fisher. Jen is a leading voice at this intersection of work and well-being and purpose. She's a sought-after speaker and a best-selling author and a podcast host. And she serves currently as the Human Sustainability Leader for Deloitte USA. She's previously served as the first ever Chief Well-being Officer for Deloitte and has built and led the creation and execution of a very pioneering, holistic, and inclusive well-being strategy that received wide acclaim. She's frequently writing on issues that are impacting the workplace today, like mental health and social connection and resilience and happiness and productivity. And she's been featured in leading media like CNN and CNBC, Fast Company, Fortune, Harvard Business Review. It's the co-author of a best-selling book, Work Better Together, How to Cultivate Strong Relationships to Maximize Well-being and Boost the Bottom Line. She's a TEDx speaker and editor at large for Thrive Global, a host of her own Work Well podcast series, and has recently started a brand new Substack newsletter called Thoughts on Being Well. Great joy to have Jen in our midst. Jen, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Yeah, I mean, congratulations to you for the path that you're on. This goes back a few years, and today, well-being is very much top of mind with the state of mental health in the world, the COVID and post-COVID, of course, stressors and challenges that have come up, and just the growing awareness in the business world that people are human. You know, they're not just automatons, and they have a hunger for purpose, a hunger for belonging, a hunger for autonomy, and all these kind of human, you know, aspirations and needs we all have for how we can ultimately live a life well lived and bring some of those aspirations to how we engage with work. I want to go back, like, several years ago when you got onto this path and became a pioneering force for it at Deloitte and ultimately then in the voice you had beyond as well. Could you talk a little bit about sort of your, you know, your early professional years and what you've done and then what led to this kind of shift for you?
Absolutely. So I have been with Deloitte for 23 years. So pretty much the entirety of my career. And I started in a marketing role. And in school, I studied business and business management and ultimately marketing. But the truth is that my father was an accountant. He also worked in, I think it was the Big Eight and the Big Six, and now it's the Big Four. And so he worked in one of the large accounting and consulting firms. And so the truth is, I didn't know really what I wanted to be when I went into college. I wanted to be a personal trainer. And my parents didn't think that that was such a good idea, although I still think it's a pretty great idea. So I went into accounting, actually, and I got through accounting intermediate too. And I said, there's no way I can do this for the rest of my life. So at that time, I switched into business management and marketing, but I was still so passionate about health and well-being, and in particular at that time, exercise. And so I have a weird minor in exercise physiology. But as I look back on my path and my career and what I'm doing now, perhaps there was some interesting foreshadowing there going on about how the worlds were going to come together later on in my life. As I started my career, I was in marketing. I did pretty well, moved up quickly through the ranks, and then went on to be the chief of staff for one of our former CEOs here at Deloitte. And so an incredible role gives you a ton of knowledge and exposure. But I would also say that for many of us that do the role, either knowingly or unknowingly, it's not the kind of role that has the most work-life balance associated with it. And that's okay. I counsel a lot of people about those types of roles. And so what I tell them is, do it for a defined period of time. Know what you want to put into it and know what you want to get out of it. And I think that that's true with anything in our career. But I didn't know that. And I didn't get that guidance and counseling along the way. And so when I came out of that role and went back into our marketing organization, the truth is that I found myself in a complete state of burnout. And this was 9 years ago. And as you know, we weren't talking about these things 9 years ago in the workplace. And so I knew there was something wrong. I didn't know what I was experiencing. But more importantly, as I look back on it, when we live and work in a culture that is so high performing, we're also really good at showing up and pretending like everything is okay. And so because I didn't know what I was going through, and I looked around and I saw so many other people that seemed fine, you know, seemed like they could handle it, I processed it as more of a personal failure and that somehow I couldn't cut it, that I didn't fit in here. And I was afraid to ask for help because I thought that if I asked for help or I sought out help, that that would be perceived as some sort of weakness. And so I let it get so bad that I eventually got to the point where I had to take time off from work, where I physically and mentally and emotionally, I just couldn't engage in life or work in any meaningful way. And so I had to seek out the help that I needed, primarily from a mental health perspective. And truthfully, that personal journey is, for so many of us, unfortunately, is what changes us. It's the wake-up call that we need. And, you know, going on that journey myself and this recognition that there's so much more to who we are as human beings and our well-being than just physical health. Because for me, it was always about, I was an athlete growing up, so exercise was always a part of my life and still is today a very important part. But there's so much more. I didn't have that realization until I struggled with burnout, until I started to struggle with my mental health. And so I took that time off, came back to work, and sat down with my leader, who is still today a great friend and mentor. And I was actually going to resign from Deloitte. And so it was her vision, probably more so than mine, where she said, you're not resigning, you're not leaving, because if you need this, there's a lot of other people here that need it too. That was kind of like a mind-blowing moment of like, wait, what? And so she's the one that really kind of gave me the permission and the platform to go down the path of exploring what corporate well-being could and should look like. And again, this was 8 years ago where we weren't talking about these things in the same way in the workplace, not to say that organizations didn't care or didn't have good benefits or great benefits for their people, but we weren't embedding it into the culture. And we certainly didn't have a language to talk about it. We didn't have the research and the data to back it up in terms of the impact and the value of it that we now have. And so in some ways, it's now easier, but there's a lot of other things today that are making it harder too. So I think we've come a long way, but we still have a lot of work to do inside of the workplace and outside of the workplace, quite frankly.
Let's continue to unpack that, you know, in stages. I want to sort of get back to that place where you now have this wake-up call internally. You go back to the workplace and suggest that you should resign. Your mentor actually invites you to take what is a growing awareness in you and use it as a platform that can help serve others at Deloitte, which was definitely very perceptive of her, like you said, all those years ago. What does someone like you, a professional who's worked in marketing, been chief of staff, has this passion for training, and now is getting to have a greater awareness about well-being in general, what are the first steps that you take to now take this corporate-wide sort of platform that is emerging and give it shape and definition and form and, you know, get some early wins? Or what is it that you did in the first year?
It's a really great question. You're going to laugh, but it's the truth. The first thing that I did, I mean, obviously we laid out kind of the business case and the strategy because I did have to kind of put that together for the broader leadership. And I will say that I think that at Deloitte, I got very lucky because the business case wasn't a hard sell to the leaders. And it was framed around high performance in many ways, or for sure requires people to be well. And if we don't have a workforce that is well and taking care of themselves and feels supported to take care of themselves and all of the other things that we didn't know then that we now know that are impacting people's well-being at work, which we can get into, we're really sub-optimizing the bottom line of the business, right? Because what Deloitte does for our clients is our brain power, right? It's helping clients, it's helping the world's largest, most important companies solve the most complex problems that they have and that the world has in many ways. And so you need really smart people performing really, really well to do that and to do it consistently, right? It's not like, you know, the research that I looked at the time was really based on high performance in sports because that was the only research that really existed, right? And so the comparison to kind of high performance in sports, but where that diverges in the working world is that an athlete trains to perform for a season or an event. Someone in business trains to perform literally all the time. And so it is in many ways the same, but also a very different animal. And so the part that I said you were going to laugh about is, you know, one of the first things we did was to create a framework because we're accountants and consultants. And so we need a framework. Without a framework, we don't go anywhere. So we created a framework of what does well-being mean at Deloitte? And what can you as an employee of Deloitte expect from a well-being perspective from the organization? How will we empower you? What does that look like? What's supported? But we also created a language because we didn't talk about these things in the world of work, you know, 8 years ago. And so we kind of had to give people the language to speak about it and the permission to speak about it and show that we really meant something by it. Because I think a lot of people can probably relate that in big organizations and probably in medium and small, sometimes we get really excited about initiatives and we go all in on an initiative. And then 2 years later, or even a year later, we all kind of look back and we were like, wait, what happened to that thing? And so it was really important to me and my colleagues and also my leaders that this wasn't an initiative, that this was truly something that we were committed to for the long term, which meant that we may not see ROI in year one or even year two, although we do and we did, but you know, that this was something that, like any change management, takes time because it's really challenging in many ways the mindsets and the behaviors of the world of work. And that continues to evolve and change. I don't know that that has calmed down any. I think as we learn more and the world gets more difficult to live in and operate in, that becomes even more of a need and perhaps even more challenging to accomplish because we live in this world that seemingly feels and looks very divided.
Let's talk about sort of what it takes to bring well-being at scale in corporate culture, which is very hard-driving, very ambitious, very performance-based. You know, what have you found to be the greatest sort of early untapped opportunities or what an organization can take on and do that lead to any kind of like meaningful, tangible gains that perhaps can be even measured and create an early sense of momentum?
So what I will say about measurement, and that's probably a whole different topic, is I know that this is difficult in business, but putting measurement aside, because although we can and will get to measurement, I think what you ultimately see if done right in the first year or two, you actually see and feel the change. So you don't need to measure it, or you can measure it, but what you see and feel is so impactful and so meaningful. And so I think the most important thing that we all have a responsibility for, whether we are leaders or colleagues, regardless of our role or our level in the organization, is to talk about it and to open up the conversation. But I do think that it's really important as leaders of an organization to authentically and meaningfully get behind the effort. And what I mean by authentically and meaningfully is you have to walk the talk. This can't be, you know, the workforce of today is really, really smart and has a different set of expectations. And they want to know who their leaders are and what their leaders stand for and what their leaders believe in. And they can sniff it out when it's not real and authentic. And so leaders do need to be authentic. And so that is going to look different for every single leader. Their stories are all going to be different. Their level of comfort in terms of vulnerability is going to be different, but leaders need to walk the talk. That's the first thing. I think the other really important thing that is showing up in the data now is well-being is actually a leadership skill set. And it's a skill set that can be trained, however we don't train it. And so it needs to move out of the realm of being a nice to have or soft skill and become an essential skill, maybe not a hard skill because those are more technical in nature, but it really is an essential leadership skill that to date, most organizations have kind of left it to chance and said, well, you know, we have some managers that are good at it and some that aren't. And that's just not cutting it. It really needs to be part of the leadership skill set. It needs to be something that people are taught, people are goaled against, you know, that is part of the performance expectations, not a carrot and a stick, but this is something we genuinely care about and you need to know how to lead through the lens of well-being if you are a people leader or manager at an organization. And then I think empowering your people. One of the things that we did fairly early on at Deloitte was because we were getting so much feedback and excitement from our workforce, they wanted to engage. And so many of our people have, you know, this passion for different aspects of well-being outside of work, but they wanted a way to bring it to work with them. And so whether they were certified meditation instructors or yoga instructors or something in nutrition or you name it, they exist in our workforce and they were reaching out like, how can I help? How can I get involved? And so really creating a community, we call it Wellbeing Wizards, but we've created several thousand, I think we're about up to 7,000 by this point of our people where we've created a community and a platform and a way for them to bring their passion around well-being to work with them within their teams, within the organization. And I think the power and beauty of that is, number one, no organization is going to have a huge well-being team. We don't at Deloitte. That's just kind of the way it is. And so you have to learn to influence and leverage the resources within your organization in a different way. And there's no better way, I think, than empowering your own people to say, this is something we really care about here. And if this is your passion, by all means, bring it to work with you. The experience for them is enhanced. But then I think also kind of the ripple effect is if I see my colleague doing it, that means I can also do it too. Because we tend to kind of look around, like I said, in my own story, when I was burning out, I looked around and I was like, okay, well, it's only me. You know, this is the flip side, right? If I see my colleague showing up to our team meeting and leading a meditation or talking about something from a well-being perspective, that permissions me to do the same. And permission when it comes to well-being, I think in our organizations, is still really, really important. I hope we get to the point one day where people don't feel like they need permission, but they still do.
Are there any sort of practices that have taken hold institutionally or like certain sort of shared rituals or things? Or are these initiatives that have been self-chosen and administered either by individuals for themselves or small clusters and groups or communities coming together with the initiative of one of these well-being wizards who's leading kind of a yoga session for them, or, you know, certain managers who are that much more embracing of this ethos and making it part of their kind of leadership style? Or, yeah, so has it been more bottom up, or have there been certain things be very practical for an organization of this scale and diversity to even implement top down?
Yeah, it's been both bottom up and top down. Absolutely. And I think that the bottom up in most organizations is already happening. The workforce is demanding it and doing it, and it is showing up in many different ways beyond just somebody leading a meditation, but the workforce is speaking their mind. But so it has to be top down and bottom up. In terms of top down and some of the things that we do at Deloitte that has been really impactful, we call it team behaviors and norms. And so through our research, and my co-author Ann Phillips and I talk a lot about this in our book, Work Better Together, the research that we did, and probably not surprising, but we wanted the data behind it, is that the people that have the biggest impact on your well-being day in, day out is, number one, your direct leader and manager. Like we've seen that research beyond, that the direct leader and manager or manager has as big of an impact on your mental health as your partner or spouse. That's pretty amazing and alarming at the same time. But beyond that, it's our team. And how do you define team? Team is the people that I spend the most time engaging with on a day in, day out basis, right? And so they are the ones that have the biggest impact on both my well-being and my behavior around my well-being. And so we created a program that around team behaviors and norms, where we empower all of our teams to come together on a regular basis. This is not just a one and done, but come together on a regular basis and talk about what's important to each individual on that team when it comes to their well-being. What do they need? What type of support did they need from the team? And to generally talk about and put into place working norms. And so what do I mean by that? We're a global organization. We have a huge workforce that is in India. And so we work across time zones. And so what are our expectations when it comes to work, right? What are the expectations in terms of email response time? What are the expectations of when I'm supposed to be on or need to be on? And a lot of this came about, honestly, as a result of the pandemic, when I think we went to we were hybrid before, but we all went to completely virtual. And a lot of people at Deloitte and otherwise were working more and more and more hours, probably because it was a coping mechanism, because we felt like we could control work and we couldn't control anything else that was going on. But that led to higher and higher levels of exhaustion and overwhelm. And, you know, so setting parameters around, okay, these are our standard working hours as a team, you know, and it might be a team across time zones, but these are the hours where we can all kind of expect to be online and collaborate with each other, right? So those types of things that normally, when I started in the role 8 years ago, the things that we thought about or the things that we implemented nationally were really programs, tools, and resources to help educate our people on the importance of movement and exercise, the importance of rest and recovery and sleep, the importance of nutrition and how to fuel your body in ways that allow you to, not from a diet perspective, but just an understanding of how food impacts your ability to be present and engaged and how it affects you cognitively, those types of things. And if you step back, not that those are unimportant, they're still very important and foundational, but a lot of those things happen outside of the traditional workday. And what we didn't think about at the time, 8 years ago, was the impact that work was actually having on people's well-being. And so I think what the pandemic highlighted for us, and you kind of step back now and you're like, well, that was dumb. Why didn't you think about that? Is the actual impact that, like, the way that we're working and the expectations around work, and also, more importantly, the lack of clarity around how I'm supposed to work, when I'm supposed to work, and where I'm supposed to work. And you're seeing that play out across the globe and in the media, in the big swings of everybody's going to the office, nobody's going to the office, there's no clarity of when to go to the office, how to go to the office, what the expectations are. Now you're seeing headlines that, you know, people that work remotely aren't getting promoted or getting laid off more, you know, those types of things. And so we still haven't figured it out. But I do think the fact that the conversation is being had more and more is a positive. I just don't think that any organization has it fully figured out. But I think the fact that we're talking about it is a positive thing, even though it's being talked about in a very negative way sometimes.
You know, some of this seems to me to be almost a commentary also on the lacking of our educational system. Why is it that right from school onwards, we are not really given the space and the resources through which to educate ourselves about well-being as something we have to be personal stewards of, you know, in our own lives? And then how do we create positive work environments? You know, I mean, like, this sounds like basic, like, civic responsibility and personal responsibility and things that now we as employers are feeling tasked with, help open people up to the relationship with food, the relationship with work life, and all of that. It's interesting.
Boundaries. Boundaries is a huge moment.
And so much of it is personal, right? I mean, I remember a moment in one of my classes at Columbia a decade ago or so, and there was a student who was highly disengaged, you know, and I shared this story in my book. I would come out some days feeling kind of like I was beating myself up that, Hetendra, you're teaching obviously a you know, highly irrelevant class because look at it, like she's just so disengaged. And other days I would come out feeling like, you know, she's just not academically, you know, motivated at all and must be here just to network and look for a job. And we need to admit more suitable students, you know, at Columbia. And then one day in the middle of the semester, she comes up to me and just shares a little bit of her story and how she's looking for some help and wonders if I could be of some support to her because she's just not engaged at all. And the reason she's not engaged is because her father died over the summer. And she's still struggling with that grief and loss and a sense of meaninglessness, you know, meaninglessness to everything that is going on in her life on the outside, given what she's struggling with on the inside. And meanwhile, the semester is going by and she wants to kind of pick up the thread of her life again and all of that. Anyway, so, you know, obviously I felt extremely foolish, you know, at that point about all these weeks of mind reading and just assumptions I'd made about sort of what was going on with her life. But it just, you know, as a story, it just illustrates, you know, for me, the very unique personal circumstances each of us is in any given moment. And even the same person who I knew yesterday or the previous semester could be a whole different person, you know, the next semester because of something unique that has come up. And unless we create the space for people being able to openly express and share and be invited to offer up what maybe certain unique considerations that, you know, for a period of time, it's important for us to take into account for them, whether it's relationship issues or health issues or beyond, you know, it's just like we're flying dark, you know, and blind, you know, in regard to sort of our inability to know and just create a generic kind of standard for every employee in every day. Has that been part of like...
Yeah, for sure. And I think that that is very much reflective of the thinking behind well-being as a leadership skill set, right? Like being able to identify when somebody is struggling. We don't see it now, but I think not different from your story. I have a story like that, but we tend to personalize it and make it about us when it really hadn't. I mean, I think that's human nature, right? Is to kind of go like, wait, maybe I'm, you know, it's our own insecurities, right? As opposed to kind of stepping outside of ourselves and saying, 9 times out of 10 and even 10 times out of 10, it has nothing to do with you. And so as a leader, how do you lean in and have the right conversations with people? And how do you feel comfortable doing that? Because I think what we've seen and what we've found, especially when someone is struggling with their mental health or struggling emotionally, I think that a lot of people are afraid to have those conversations or uncomfortable having those conversations because not because they're bad people, but because they're afraid they're going to say something wrong or do something wrong, right? And that's the absolute worst thing you can do is not have the conversation because you're scared of saying something wrong. Because most of the time, all of the time, the person doesn't expect you to fix it. They know it's not your job to fix it, but they also want to know that they're seen and heard and not alone. And as somebody who struggled with her mental health, it is a very, especially grief. I just published an article on this. Grief can be very, very isolating. And because we live in a society where we don't talk about grief, we certainly don't talk about death. I mean, they're almost taboo topics. When they show up, and grief, by the way, as you know, can come about by way more than just death, but we just don't talk about it, right? And so it's a misunderstood emotion. So when somebody's going through it, it's very isolating for them. But when we perceive somebody might be struggling, you know, it feels so uncomfortable to have that conversation. But I think as a leader, the most important thing, the most important role you play is having that conversation. And that's what I mean by well-being as a leadership skill set, because we don't teach people how to have those conversations. And you can teach people how to have those conversations. And that's not to say that you won't always feel uncomfortable, but at least you'll have this skill set or the knowledge in, okay, how do I approach this? What do I say? How do I just sit and be there with the person and not try to fix it? Because I also think in the business world and for very high performing individuals, you know, we want to jump in and fix things, right? And when we can't fix things, it drives us crazy. And so just being able to sit there and be with somebody is uncomfortable, and to kind of sit and, you know, metaphorically hold their hand through it isn't comfortable for a lot of people. And I understand that. And that's why we do need to teach it.
I couldn't agree with you more. I think that it's been a journey for me in my own career and life, you know, having over the years moved from being in consulting and startups to actually teaching, and then having just so many students graduating from under your watch every year. And inevitably, you know, some percentage of them at some point or the other go through something significant. And then suddenly you're thrust in that role where they see you, you know, as the mentor. And, you know, how are you meant to show up? How are you meant to, like you said, metaphorically hold their hand through that moment, both be there to understand, perhaps adapt or adjust whatever it is that, you know, their contract with you is, you know, as a professor, but also, you know, but also somehow like light a spark, you know, like remind them of the hero within, anchor them in their own innate strength, because we all have it. We all have it. Humanity is born through so much.
We wouldn't still be here if we didn't have it.
And so making them feel affirmed as well, you know, for what capacities they can tap into within. You know, it's been a really eye-opening and rewarding journey for me over the years to become more comfortable in those spaces which were otherwise so uncomfortable, right? And more I've been intrigued about what we can do, like you said, to help others just unleash that capacity and potential in them to be supporters, you know, be caring, empathetic managers, friends, colleagues in moments like that for the people around them. So that, God forbid, you know, we have to go through a COVID moment again or anything like that. The Israel-Palestine conflict has been another example of a flare-up like that that is just like, you know, stirred and shaken so many hearts, right? And so leaders have been unexpectedly thrust into these moments more often than they would have, you know, calculated in the last few years, and perhaps will in the years ahead. But yeah, creating the capacity, I mean, if that's part of like what you're doing, you know, in that sort of well-being and human sustainability arena at Deloitte, I kudos to you. And it's something I'm personally very invested in. In fact, like I'm working with, you know, generative AI now to kind of train it based on the methods and approaches I've used. And now I'm training it to be a version of that so that people can interact with it. And it kind of, you know, kind of helps support and act as that kind of agent of inspiration.
I love that. And I think that unlike so many of the headlines that we read about generative AI, certainly there's risks and threats associated with it. But I think that there's an incredible opportunity to use generative AI to really enhance who we are as human beings, or said differently, allow us to be truly human and to know that when we show up as human, that that's what's valued. And that truly is kind of the work and the definition, if you will, for human sustainability. And we do have a big thought leadership piece coming out on February 6th on it. But really, human sustainability is this, you know, from an organizational perspective, what is the responsibility of an organization and its leaders to create value for people as human beings, right? And so when you think about kind of the traditional or historical work model, and not that it was bad, but so much has changed and humans have evolved in a very different way, and there's very different needs that, you know, we have to move away from this extractive view of, you know, an organization hires you to do a job and they pay you, and that's the end of the relationship. Because the most important thing for every organization, whether it's a business, a university, a school, otherwise, is human relationships. And so, and will always be human relationships. And so, yes, we have generative AI, we have the promise of all of these technologies, but the human is still here and will still always be here. And we need to think differently. We need to adopt a different mindset and a different behavior on how we view and how we engage and interact in those relationships with humans in the workplace and inside and out. And one thing we haven't touched on is that is also kind of a threat to our humanity and the way that we live and work in many ways is climate change and all of the work that is being done around climate change and the regulations and the rigor around ESG. But if you look deeply into that, the S, which is the human component, the social component, is the component of ESG that has the least amount of rigor, the least amount of investment, and quite frankly, the least amount of understanding. And so it's not that people don't want to do anything about it or that leaders don't think that it's valuable. They just don't know what to do. And so we're lacking in kind of that definition and how do we move forward with these human relationships when there is so much going on that is changing from a technology perspective, but also the things in our world that continue to divide us. And to me, that's a real threat and a real concern.
So let's maybe turn to that in just a moment. I want to ask you one question before we get there. You mentioned that there is a thought leadership that you're publishing in February sometime, something perhaps to do with AI. Could you just kind of talk about what that is in case people want to look for?
Oh, so it's multiple things. So every year Deloitte does it's called our annual human capital trends. And so it's a big in-depth look at what we believe the trends in the human capital and the human space are going to be. And a key trend for 2024, amongst other things, is human sustainability. There's a handful of other topics. One most notably is around measurement and productivity and why we need to move away from productivity as a true measure of success in the workplace, which I am a huge advocate for. But that's a whole different conversation that we would probably need to have. But anyway, if people are interested, there's a lot in there, obviously, about AI and generative AI and its impact. Yeah, that comes out in early February.
Sounds like you have been a key contributor and then author of that. So we look forward to seeing what you and your team are saying. I couldn't agree with you more about the metrics, you know, being a critical part of the transformation work that we're all sort of invested in this space, i.e., you know, you get what you measure, right? And so we have to challenge and evolve those metrics. One of the areas that I've been personally very passionate about is how we measure people's personality. And this notion of Myers-Briggs and DISC and all of that have, you know, held us well for 30, 40, 50 years in the early evolution of, like, you know, organizational psychology. But I think should respectfully be kind of gradually put to rest, because there is just so much that one is discovering now about the capacities latent in all of us for transcending any of these little boxes, you know, and being able to be kind of like very diversity of different personalities or behaviors, depending on sort of what the moment needs from us. Whether it's to be agreeable or whether it's to be assertive or whether it's to be adaptable or whether it's to be tenacious, you know, which seem kind of opposing of each other. And you don't have to be just one or the other. You could, you know, a thinker or a feeler. You could be both, you know, if you really activate all the neural kind of pathways that we have access to in our brains anyway. So that's something, you know, the metrics, you know, really strike a chord with me. I can pose that, you know, something I've learned from some of the story leaders and lives from history. So this is something that, for example, I learned from John Wooden, the most successful college basketball coach. You must be familiar with that, UCLA. And so here he is, you know, he's led to record winning sort of outcomes for his team and really by far the outlier in terms of how successful he is versus the second or third or fourth most successful college basketball coach. But on the other hand, he would tell his players, he said, I don't care if we win or lose. I only care that when you walk away from the basketball coach at the end of the game, you know, were you convinced that you played your best game? And it wasn't even like whether I was convinced, you know, whether you were convinced, right? Because who knows, maybe you're sick that day or you've had a certain injury or something. I mean, I wouldn't know what is the appropriate level to which you should be pushing your body or not and all of that. And we certainly cannot control, you know, how good the competition is and how well they're trained and resourced. But he said, but my feeling is that, like, if consistently you're able to walk away from the basketball court feeling like you played your best game, over time, we're going to end up like surprising ourselves how many games we'll win. And I really like this idea of like inner metrics, which are almost metrics of conscience, right? Like if we can activate people's conscience and have them be paying attention to what's the energy I'm bringing into the room? What's the mood? What's the intention I'm bringing into the room? Am I being able to put my ego aside? Am I here to serve a noble collective purpose? Am I striving to tune in to the, you know, aspirations of the people around me? Am I curious and open to growth? You know, so I have like these five inner metrics. And I just wonder what it would be if we could create a climate where leaders can just inspire and infuse people with that self-responsibility, that personal accountability of just actively calibrating themselves according to those inner metrics. And of course, then you measure what you can measure on the outside. But for the most part, people are doing their own self-regulation and assessment all the time.
I think that would significantly change the world of work. And I do think that this notion of, you know, well-being as a leadership skill set has to start with you first, right? Because it is almost impossible to create an environment or a culture of work that puts the human at the center, promotes and supports human health and well-being, if the leader isn't leading in that way or isn't doing it for themselves. And so I talk a little bit about this actually in my TEDx talk, that it has to start with us, right? Because it's true. I mean, we, even as leaders, if we try to mask that. It comes out in different ways, and people see it and feel it. And our workforce is looking to us as to, you know, I said previously, like, leaders have to walk the talk. And if you're just talking the talk and not actually walking the talk, that's more detrimental than actually doing nothing at all, because people are looking to you to role model what's accepted here and how I can be successful here. And so if you're saying one thing and doing another, the perception, actually what's more important than what you're saying is the perception of what it takes to be successful here, right? And so people see and feel that. So we have to lead ourselves first, 100%. So count me in, however I can help move that journey forward. I think that would be a huge disruptor for the world of work, and much, much needed.
One of the things that the science of expert performance, you know, when you look at the world champions versus the national versus the local champions, people who didn't make it to the world level, you know, one of the things you study and see in them is that they are able to see more dimensions, you know, to the game than others are. An expert pianist will kind of walk into, you know, Carnegie Hall or wherever, and not just focus on the Moonlight Sonata they have to play, you know, Beethoven, whatever, but they'll actually focus on the piano, they'll focus on the acoustics of the room, the humidity and the air quality, and therefore what that is going to do to the sound. And so they have these other dimensions, these invisible dimensions, right?
Yeah.
And I mean, what I'm thinking here is that, Jen, that, I mean, these faculties that you and I are just talking about, these are those hidden dimensions, you know, of what makes a leader really exemplary versus just fly-by-night, you know, who had their day in the sun for a year or two or four. But sustainable, great kind of transformational leadership, those folks, the Gandhis, the Mother Teresas, the Eleanor Roosevelts and others, I mean, what I find is that they were really tuning into these subtler inner kind of energies, these the mental health and the thinking and intentions and emotions, the emotions in the room, right?
Yeah.
And nurturing and feeding the soul, you know, at that level.
I think that that's so true. I think that the other thing that we all have a responsibility for, but leaders and just societally, I think that along with that comes the definition of success. And what does success mean? And what does success look like for you? Not what society tells you success is or looks like. But I think that we've kind of gone a little off kilter on that, right? In that we have created this definition, this societal definition of success that most people will never reach in their life. And many that do, you ultimately find aren't very happy,
yeah.
Right? And so, and that comes from the inside. And that's work that needs to be done to say, this is my definition of success. It doesn't actually matter what yours is or anybody else's is. And that's what I reflect when I think of that, you know, what you're saying that Wooden was saying is right. Like if you're good here and you're meeting your own needs and expectations, then you can truly show up and serve others.
So true. Mother Teresa, she said, you know, you cannot give what you do not have. I hear that a little bit in what you're just saying. I realize we have confines of time, and this itself was so soulful, so beautiful. We could spend eternity right here. But I'm going to zoom out for a second. You talked about ESG and social, and in particular, your book also focuses a lot on relationships. At a time like today, where the business, the way it was done traditionally, was upended by COVID and led to work from home, and then ultimately a hybrid world that we live in now, where, like you said, we're still trying to figure our way out of this. And I'm just curious, you mentioned the primacy of relationships and connection and belonging. What are ways in which you have found organizations or pockets in organizations or managers or teams doing that well, nurturing the human connection?
It's a really great question. I do think it's not one that we have fully solved, because I do think that the nature of our digital world, I mean, we know that even prior to the pandemic, we were living in an epidemic of loneliness. And, you know, the U.S. Surgeon General, Dr. Vivek Murthy, and his team have done so much work on this from an organizational perspective. And this is not something that Deloitte actively does right now, but it is something that we are talking about is, you know, how do we, in a world of work where there is so much going on, both from a work perspective and a personal perspective, how can we give people time and space, or actually give people credit for time and space so that we can nurture these connections? And what does that look like? And how do you do it in a way that is authentic? Because the last thing that anybody needs is an appointment on their calendar that feels like a waste of time, that, you know, I'm just doing this because Deloitte told me I have to. That's not true human connection. And so what I can say is that the beauty of human connection and reaching out to someone not only benefits them, but benefits you. And so I think that we need to kind of remember that, because I do think our tendency in a digital and virtual world is to scroll social media instead of reaching out to somebody, right? And so how can we stop that behavior and remind ourselves that it's much more beneficial to me and the other person that instead of looking at what they're doing on social media, call them. And if you don't want to call them, send them a text and say, hey, I'm thinking of you. What's going on in your life? What's going on in your world? It's simple acts like that that don't take very much time that have huge, huge benefits. And I think that's what people need to realize, because I think when we talk about or think about social connection, yes, huge chunks of time that you enjoy, that being with people that you enjoy are really, really important. But human connection can come about in so many different ways. And I think there's a lot of promising technological tools that if we use them correctly, and that's a big if, right? If we use them correctly, there's a big promise of kind of eradicating loneliness and helping to promote human connection. But I think that we just need to all remember in the workplace, and you said it so beautifully already, is that we're all human beings, and there's a really good chance that we're all struggling with something at one point or another, or there's something going on in our personal life that is showing up at work and vice versa, because there are no boundaries anymore when it comes to that, right? And so I think that we just need to remember that and come to, as much as possible, every interaction with kindness and grace. And if something feels off to you, that's the time to pick up the phone and say, hey, is everything okay? And that doesn't cost you anything, literally costs you nothing. And as a matter of fact, you get more back from it than you probably give. Not a concrete answer, but the best I got right now.
I mean, it's important to realize that this is an important quest, and yet we are evolving away into thinking about sort of the right practices. I tell you, this applies at all levels of the organization, right? I was invited to do a intervention with the board of a storied institution. And the purpose was that they felt they were entering a new era. They had a new chair and, you know, they wanted to sort of create more integration, more connection, and therefore through that, more trust, you know, across the board members, because they parachute in, they do their board meetings, they leave, they do that again the next time and the next time. And for the most part, it's a little bit perfunctory and a little bit sort of formal, but they don't really go into real great depth, you know, and really fighting and challenging and, you know, pushing, right, for the organization to kind of, you know, so they've been a little bit sort of a polite, just kind of friendly, supportive board. And now they were thinking there's a lot going on in the world and we may need to make harder calls and decisions. So, you know, so I came in, I did like a half day session on accelerating trust and creating more human intimacy and connection. And some of them were a little bit less sort of kind of initially open to it. But then I made the case for why there's so much going on in the world and you just never know when what will come towards you. And if you want to really be the stewards of this organization, which has had such a beautiful history for so long, then, you know, then this is just going to be critical. So they opened up and we actually arrived at a very good place. This was on a Friday of a 2-day kind of, you know, board, you know, offsite that they were doing. Saturday was October 7th. Wow. So of course all hell broke loose, you know, in the world. And sure enough, they were thrust in completely unexpected, you know, circumstances, needing to immediately scurry and figure out what their stance is going to be as an organization and support the head of the organization through that. And it's just illustrative, right? Of the fact that what you're talking about, this relationship gap, this need for more humanity and connection in the workplace, not just to perhaps like nurture that sort of just common hunger for not being lonely, for feeling connected and included, but also it makes us more collaborative, more open, more effective in having a team come together and do good and complex work, right?
Yeah. And I think, you know, you said it, right? trust, right? And that is, I know that was a huge topic at the World Economic Forum this year, right? Is trust and the erosion of trust in our organizations, in our, you know, in all of our institutions and governments and things like that. And the only way to rebuild trust is through building deep and respectful relationships with other human beings. That's something that cannot be replaced by any technology. Full stop.
I want to test one last thesis with you around this theme of sustainability, human sustainability in particular, being not as extractive, right? I've been recently drawn to experimenting a little bit with pushing the envelope. I mean, you've been pushing the envelope, so you can, you know, you can relate to that. I don't know if this is a frame and a language that you would buy into at the present moment as being central, important, and practical for the business world to take more of. So I'm going to test this with you. When I look at the statistics coming out from things like Pew Research and, you know, Gallup and beyond, 80%+ of people, let's say in America, right, as one example, actually believe that they are spiritual. You know, they have a spiritual side to them. In our quest to create an inclusive work environment, we have recognized that different people have different faiths and religions, and we should be appreciative and respectful of them choosing, you know, their own path, growing up in their own path, and then as a way to create a workplace that doesn't sort of impose one order on everybody, we just kind of keep silent, you know, on this topic. And that's the definition of being a secular, you know, world. It's like you don't talk about these things. But in that process, have we lost something? Is there an aspect to, if you want to call it like spiritual well-being, where we open ourselves up to a shared sort of appreciation for a sense of awe and a sense of mystery, you know, about the world? You brought up death as something that people are just not comfortable in society, you know, confronting, facing, and talking about. We don't all have to have the same shared beliefs as to what happens in that moment or beyond that moment. But that idea about living in a state of sort of appreciation for beauty in the world and for the magic of creation and a sense of just indomitability of something called the human spirit that lies at the very core of our being, and that may be ineffable but is very real, you know, and very felt by people, right, from time to time, individually and collectively, and perhaps seeing if we can all buy into a belief which may not be provable through modern metrics of science, but, you know, people like Martin Luther King have evoked, you know, at very historic moments in, you know, in our history, like that the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. It bends towards justice. That's got to be really a spiritual belief. You know, it can't be, you know, something that is purely fact-based, you know. And so anyway, well, what do you think of that? I'm starting to feel more and more invested in talking about it in my executive MBA and my MBA classes, talking about it in my keynotes and things. And I'm finding that for the most part, if you say it carefully and thoughtfully and respectfully and in an interfaith way and all that, it's kind of like stirs the spirit up, you know, in the room. So curious.
I agree with you. And I do think that, like so many of our other identities, of which all of us have many, we can't ask our workforce to leave any part of their identity at home. And that would include, you know, faith and spirituality, regardless of where your faith is or what your faith is in or where your spirituality comes from. We also know from a pure well-being perspective, but also purpose and sustainability, that faith and spirituality for so many people is a really, really important aspect of their well-being, right? It is what fuels them. It's what lights them up. And I don't think that we can ignore that. And in many ways, I think I am a student of hope. And I recently wrote a piece that hope is one of the most important strategies, because we always hear that hope isn't a strategy. Again, I think hope is a strategy, and it's a strategy that all business leaders need right now, because hope gives people a different mindset for the future. It gives them a path out of where we are now that may not feel great, but hope is what, you know, projects, allows us to move forward. Otherwise, we get stuck. And I think, to me, hope comes from a very spiritual place, because it's not rooted in data. And yes, there is some science behind it. There's a whole theory behind it, but it's hard to measure. You can't measure or quantify the value of hope. And so I put that in kind of that spirituality frame as well. And I think that it's really important. And I think that many organizations are recognizing that. At Deloitte, we do have a Faith and Allies ERG, BRG group that we've created recently because of that feedback from our workforce that, hey, this is an important part of who I am, and I want to be able to show up in the workplace. And like you said, we've lost our ability for some reason to have these types of conversations with people in a respectful way. And that's hurting us as human beings, right? I want to know about you and who you are and what makes you resilient and what you believe in. That doesn't mean I have to agree with it or I have to believe in it myself, but you know what? I might learn something. And that makes me a better person. And so I think we have to stop coming at things of like, oh, well, I don't believe that, so therefore it's taboo or has no place here. It has a place, and you don't have to believe it, but you have to show up in a way that you're willing to have the conversation and do it in a way that is safe and inclusive of other people that it matters to.
I'm so happy to hear that reaction from you. It encourages me to feel like we could have some of us unite towards this cause and gently start opening the community up. One of the hypotheses I have is that, you know, if you look at, you know, humankind's history, it's in some regards, you know, very inspiring, in some regards, not that pretty. And part of the not that pretty part was that, you know, religions were going at war with each other, and sometimes even within their own faith, you know, with regard to differing beliefs and, you know, followerships and what have you. And so over time, we got left with these scars of these interfaith kind of wars and things. And so it just became better just to kind of like take faith out of the room. Right. If you're now going to not be just in our own little kind of religious communities, but we're going to interact with people from all kinds of faiths and all of that in our communities and everything. But I think what's happened is that a large number of people today who even may ascribe to a certain faith have already gone beyond that. You know, they no longer judge people who are not from their faith as though they're going to be damned or they're inferior or they're not going to make it, you know, to their version of whatever the definition is. So,
but the rest of us are still stuck.
So there's this fear and, you know, concern about not bringing up these faith issues, thinking that we'll end up making, you know, more wars with each other, and painfully so on the margin of society. You do see some of those wars still being hoisted by, you know, religious kind of extremists. But for the most part, most people in the modern day professional world seem to go to the church or study the science or do their own yoga, whatever it is they're doing. And then they're coming in and basically being very open and appreciative of people from all kinds of backgrounds, right? So I think we have a conducive space today to create a little more of that nurturing.
Yeah, and I hope that grows because we need to get better at accepting and acknowledging all of the identities that exist within the workforce, within the human race, quite frankly, because that only makes us better.
To close our conversation, can you share what excites you the most in the direction that the business world is taking towards evolving itself into more human-centeredness, into more of this human sustainability, well-being kind of theme? Where do you see the greatest possibilities for what will unfold in the next few years?
What excites me is that these topics, in large part, were never discussed, or in some cases were either relegated to HR because they were people-related issues, or even taboo in the minds of many. And I think that the top has been blown off of that. And so I think that you would be hard-pressed to find a business leader today that would tell you that well-being and human sustainability doesn't matter. So that's what excites me, because there's a recognition, there's a talking about it, and that's where it starts, right? If we don't recognize that there's a problem, we're going to have a really hard time fixing it, right? And I think that there's a burning platform, right? For a whole lot of reasons that you and I have covered during this conversation. I think there still exists a gap between the knowing and the doing. And so how do we move, and we need to move quickly on some of these things. And so how, with all of the things that business leaders are dealing with now, and there's a lot, and all of them are a priority, which makes it very hard to make any one of them a priority. How do we move this to the top of the C-suite agenda? Because that is truly where it needs to be. It needs to sit right next to generative AI and right next to climate change, right next to trust, because we're going to have a really hard time accomplishing any of our stated goals in any of those other areas if we don't get the human component right.
Are you familiar with Paul Hawken?
No.
He's a activist and has been for a while in the environmental space.
Okay.
And some things that you were just talking about kind of connect with something he shared in a podcast I did with him, where he talks about like regeneration as being the key ethos, right? And you were talking a little bit about extractive versus, right? And so like maybe if we view everything through that regeneration lens, it connects the climate movement with this movement too of human sustainability and well-being, right? Because it's all about how you deal with everything, how you deal with other people, how do you deal with your own body, how you deal with the planet, you know, as our shared space.
And maybe I have read his work. I've read a lot of work on regenerativity and regenerative humans and how they need to rise to meet the need. And so I may not recognize the name, but I've probably read his work.
And then I like to sometimes think about also there's the outer climate, but then there's the inner climate and the inner climate of a family, the inner climate within our own selves. Within our teams, right? And what are we doing to nurture that climate also in the same way that we want the physical climate around us? So true, so beautiful. Thank you so much for taking the time to share, you know, your journey, share your aspirations, share what you have found work well, but also grounding us in the fact that this is hard work and it's a collective enterprise. And our listeners here who are also inspired and fired up about this, you know, we all have our work cut out for us. Jen, where can people go to, just kind of learn more about your ideas and thoughts and stay current with some of the things that you're doing?
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned a whole bunch of them at the beginning, but I am pretty active on LinkedIn and so happy to connect with people through LinkedIn. Obviously, I am the host of a podcast called Work Well by Deloitte, where I have the opportunity to talk to, you know, thought leaders and others in the space of well-being and well-being at work, as well as the book Work Better Together. I have a TEDx talk called The Future of Work, where I touch on many of the things that we talked about today. So lots of ways to connect and you know, see what we're up to at Deloitte and beyond. And I'd be happy to connect with anybody that wants to.
Yeah, wonderful. Wishing you many decades of, you know, joyful, not just productive, but joyful engagement with all these wonderful projects you're doing. And I am so sure that this will evolve in beautiful ways in the months and years ahead. So thank you. Thank you for all you do.
Thank you so much. This is a wonderful conversation.